Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight, another great show dealing with metaphysics and physics and death changes in physics and life after we leave this reality, this world. So this should be interesting for those of you who either do or don't believe that such a thing exists. I think you might believe it more after tonight's show, but if you don't, that's okay. And I'm going to be describing a lot of things that are based upon physics, not just metaphysics. Metaphysics means beyond physics. Physics is the physics that is more or less accepted by most scientists who call themselves physicists these days. So I would like to begin with by talking about something that may be a scary word, you know, and that scary word is the theory of relativity. Well, it's not really a theory. It's been proven pretty much time and again. But it has some unusual factors to it. And the first thing I think that most people probably are not aware of is that when Einstein came up with relativity, he did so after an older protege teacher of his named Max Planck, or Planck, some people, if they Englishize the last name, will be pronounced Planck, came up with. Now, what did Planck come up with that was so important? That Einstein used his very famous, we'll call it, series of formulas based upon one thing, and that is called the quantum constant. And it's the basis of quantum mechanics and ultimately the basis of relativity as well. As a matter of fact, if you look up Einstein's formulas, you're going to find Planck's constant used all the way through his formulas. And without that constant, it's debatable whether Einstein would have come up with his theory of relativity. He would have had to discover it for himself almost certainly. And what is this big deal about quantum constant and relativity and all these other things? Well, the quantum constant is a measure of the amount of indefiniteness of matter within space and time. So in other words, it's how much absolutely something is where you think it is on a percentage basis at any particular time within any location in space. And it doesn't sound too hard, right? You can kind of picture that, okay. But how come things aren't definite? Why isn't everything just where it's supposed to be? And when Planck was figuring this thing out, he came to the conclusion that what we think of as an absolute in terms of matter, space, and time is really a relative position based upon a probability. In other words, it's relative because it may change in relationship to other things, and especially one particular thing, which I'll name in a few minutes. But it besides changing, it may have only a probability, or does have, I should say not may, it does have a probability of the quote-unquote location being where you think it might be. Now, this has a very strange, and even the time, I mean, there's a whole other factor here that I'm not going to get too far into because that will really confuse people, but even the time is kind of probabilistic. So rarely something may be in a different time. Well, that's hard for us to understand, I know. And in actuality, time kind of, at least in terms of the quantum world, this very, very minute scale world, in some significant circumstances, it runs backwards. that doesn't make much sense. Okay. But let's not get too far into that one, because that's really a rabbit hole that nobody probably will understand tonight. But let's, or maybe a few people might. If you are into quantum physics and you really have studied this, you know what I'm saying. All right. So what does all this mean, though? I mean, this guy Planck was a true genius. As much a genius as I think we would declare Einstein to be. It's just that his genius was more expressive in terms of mathematical terms and less in thought experiments, which Einstein was probably the better genius at. But regardless, he came up with this amazing formula that determined the probability of matter as we understand it in this part of the universe. We call it the physical part of our universe, and how it's going to behave in a very, very small scale. And the reason for, when I say small, I'm talking about in mass. The reason that things behave differently when their mass gets really, 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 really tiny is that the quantum constant, which normally is extremely small itself, but it's always relative or in relationship to the mass that it's being or is affecting, as you get super small in the mass, the quantum constant no longer being such a small number is all that small in relationship to that mass, and it actually has an indefiniteness. It gives an indefiniteness to the behavior of the smallest parts of matter, getting down to sub-atomic particles, sub below the size of the particles that make up atoms. Wow. Now we're talking about some really the major particles, big atoms. So it's really, really small. And when things some of the particles themselves are also affected by it, like electrons, because they're pretty small. But even smaller than electrons, you can find particles that make up all of the particles. And those particles are really, really, really small, and they are very much affected by Planck's formula. Now, what is it that has an effect on Planck's formula? I keep talking around it, but there's got to be something that does that. Well, I'm gonna bring it in a different way, because if I just say it, everybody's going to go, huh? So let me bring it in this way. Think of it this way, that when we talk about light, okay, because the speed of light and a lot of things that about light seem to control everything. There's major, major issues. Getting into relativity again, relativity depends upon light as being the stop sign for the universe. You can't go any faster than light, supposedly, and some other factors. Unless you change dimensionality. You can go faster than light if you change dimensionality, but it's a whole other thing we're going to talk about tonight. But you can't go faster than light just by staying in the same dimensional realm. It's an absolute stop sign. Besides that, light has a lot of other features to it that are just amazing. In metaphysical terms, now I get into the physics beyond physics, in metaphysical terms, light is the first part and the major part of the thought of God, which we call spirit. But there's a second part to the thought of God called consciousness. Consciousness is the ability to use light in developing new thought and connecting thought together. So if you want to connect thoughts together and if you want to make new thought by doing that, then you have to use consciousness. And light always has an element of consciousness with it, because in order for anything to be enlightened, in other words, it has to contain light, it has to be conscious to a certain level, which we'll talk about tonight as well. And so the fascinating thing about this is light is a big deal, because it's the first part of God's thought, and it's the first part of God's mind, and it can always contain, if it exists at all as light, it contains the second part of God's mind as well. Wow. Pretty cool. All right. So, and when consciousness becomes relatively enlightened, at the level that it can be enlightened to, then light takes on a new kind of dimension in that it helps to grow life and maintains a certain level of balance in the life. And in the world that we live in, we call it virtue, and because it enlightens form as well as consciousness. Wow. So this is pretty cool stuff. It has a lot of stuff. Now, what is form? Form is energy in another perspective, and particularly where we exist at, we can consider it energy. And when light has an effect on energy, the energy behaves in a way which helps the form itself to become more easily enlightened. Ah, that doesn't sound so hard to understand. We can even buy into that. If you're into any kind of metaphysical approach, you can say, yeah, it can make sense, or a spiritual approach. It can make sense, right? All right, so here's the bottom line, and most people don't know this. Energy follows thought that has a relative level of enlightenment greater than its propensity towards darkness. Okay, so there's a relative term. And how do we know that? Well, it's incorporated in Planck's formula of quantum constant when applied into relativity or Einsteinian physics. So when you join these together, you find that's the answer. You can solve the equations and come up with that conclusion. You say, well, that's just some of your concoction, isn't it? No. Not really. This was really discovered in the mid-1920s. And Einstein didn't quite realize it himself until then. So it's a kind of a fascinating idea. Energy follows thought that has greater thought than the energy. Energy is a follower of thought. And it seeks, in a sense, to be enlightened, provided that it is not, we'll say, so strong in relative terms that in its own thought that it overwhelms the relative thought of that around it. And instead of that enlightened thought having some degree of enlightenment on the energy, the form itself becomes darker because of its own, we'll call it, thought. Now, what is a thought of energy? Well, another word for the thought of energy is gravity. And that sounds strange. Why would gravity be the thought of energy? Well, if you go into the quantum constant and Einsteinian physics, and you start doing solving for various parts of the equations, you come up with that conclusion. Oh. It's a mathematical. It actually is. However, very few people who are physicists actually recognize this, unless they followed some of the German physicists of the 1920s who came up with this concept and began to realize that it was true. Energy follows thought greater than its own. And so this means, and I'll give you an example. Let's say you have an electron. That's the biggest kind of thing you can do this with. You can do it with a quark. Quarks are much more interesting, but most people don't know what a quark is, and they think it has to do with something that a duck does. So that's a quack. But the point is that here's the way it works. And it's kind of interesting. Let's say you have an electron. And you just let the electron go where it might go, okay? Well, then it only goes in places based upon probability. So you never know exactly where that electron might be. It could be someplace very far away, or it could be right under your nose. And there's a percentage, which is very high, that the electron's going to go in a certain direction. But if you're observing the electron, you would be affecting the electron because in order to observe, theoretically, you're using some form of light, even if it's something you wouldn't construe as light, like sound. But you're using some kind of a measurement, and you're also fascinating thinking. All right? And the electron is going to be influenced by the observation, quote-unquote, slash thought of the observer. That sounds so hard to believe, but it is absolutely true. You can do all kinds of experiments to prove this, and it's been proven way more times than I can think of. And it always appears to be correct. So that's just part of it. There's a lot more. But at least for tonight, we'll say that there's adequate proof in mathematical formulas and in actual experiments in laboratories and a lot of other things that these ideas of quantum physics, as odd as they seem, are actually correct, and they occur in such strange ways. Now we get into some really odd stuff, and that is dimensionality. According to Planck's constant, it only is effective in its way it's numerically valued in the physical part of the world, the physical universe. There are extrapolations where you can take this constant and you can change the constant. If you change the constant, the speed of light changes. That's a big change. The amount that energy follows thought changes. And as a matter of fact, the odd thing is, as you increase dimensionality, if you increase dimensionality, the amount that energy follows thought goes thousands of times, grows by thousands of times. And so thought becomes a major factor in how energy forms. Remember, energy is the stuff that we make forms out of anything. And so if you go to a different dimension of time and space, and we're all going there, believe me, say when you die or if you travel there in your consciousness, leave your physical body there, and enter into a different body within that particular dimension, appropriate for the dimension, your senses and your thought have a dramatic effect on all of the form, all of the energy that's available, because there's an extra dimension of time and space, and the dimension that even slightly exists here expands by double, which is the dimension of time. So you have all kinds of strange things that start to take place. It's not that it's some kind of voodoo magic. It's just the opposite. It's very, very scientific. And there was a guy who wrote a book. I can't remember his name right now. It might come to me. In the late 40s, called Mr. Tompkins, first in Wonderland and Explores the Atom and that sort of stuff. Now they've made an abridged version of those two books. And in this particular book, although it doesn't deal with life after death per se, it deals with going to other dimensional realms and what happens to the quantum constant. And so it's kind of an interesting idea. And in that book, if you want to get it, it's very interesting to read, Mr. Tompkins in Wonderland, along with, I think, the Explorers of the Atom is now together, and it tells you a lot of the things that you're going to hear about tonight in tonight's show. It even has a fairly large section in the back of the book that's all the math, which is not that easy, but the rest of the book is pretty understandable by most people. And so that's a fascinating book. I read that book when I was a youngster, very young. And so that book, to me, was like, wow, this is cool stuff. All right, so going to another dimension changes the quantum constant. It grows enormously. And so does, effectively, the speed of light. So some things change in relationship to time and space. The amount that matter follows time and space is changed. The amount that thought affects matter or energy, it's not really matter anymore, but we'll call it the energy of the next realm, sometimes referred to as astral realm. In that realm, things just don't function the way they do here. And that means there's going to be a lot of things to change for the people who live there. And that's what we're going to talk about tonight. But we're first dealing with some of the science about this. All right, so what kinds of things start to change when you change the quantum constant? Well, probably the most profound thing has to do with time. Time becomes a bit more connected, quite a bit, over twice, more times connected with space than it is in the realm we're in. Now, what does that mean? Time is more connected with space. Well, when you separate time from space, as it is the maximum level it could be where we hang out, when you separate time from space, senses do not work very well. Their ability to accurately determine the surrounding world is kind of mixed up and lost. It becomes more difficult to correctly think. And probably the most important thing is energy barely follows thought, barely at all, and pretty much is doing its own thing. Gravity grows enormously. So we live in a gravity-dominated part of the universe where our whole existence revolves around gravity and the consequences of that, which includes things like high levels of forces and friction, inertia, the inability to get things to move very easily. And once they are moving, the inability to get them to change direction very easily. All kinds of things start to become piled on one on the other, making it a difficult world to live in. And there's good reason for that, because life is challenged the most where we are right now in the physical world. That challenge helps us to develop a stronger, over time, a lot of time, a lot of lifetimes, understanding of our Creator, because it's under the most difficult of circumstances, that people begin to see deeper understandings of their Creator. That sounds a little problematic, doesn't it? So, in other words, we may not really gain a high level of consciousness if we're living in a easy place with low gravity, low inertia. Then it might be just too easy to grow our consciousness well enough, high enough, to gain a much better understanding in consciousness or within consciousness of God. So this realm is very important because it challenges us to do that in ways other realms will not. So one of the things we lose when we die is because of the changes in physics, our life becomes easier in some ways that we think of as difficult, but very much more difficult to gain a clear understanding of God. One way to understand this is that we would have a better understanding of the superficial aspects and that God really does exist by going to the astral realm. But a deep understanding of God would be much more difficult to realize because the need to create is lessened, and the foundations of what consciousness is, which is the connection of creation to modify and change and create new things, becomes more superficial because people seldom go very deep in that experience, because whatever they imagine virtually takes place, and that, even if it goes against the science of the physics we're familiar with here, and that allows people to live without having to question as much, without having to create as much, and without having to understand the nature of God's mind, and the laws, we'll call it, of physics, in metaphysics, and the laws of God itself, they aren't as needed to live a pretty good life, easy life, in the next realms that we go on to live in. So people are a little less motivated or a lot less, and that usually leaves them in a position of less growth per period of time. Now, it's somewhat compensated by the fact that there are things that are obvious in these other dimensions of time and space that are completely hidden from us here. So that's somewhat compensatory, but it only helps us get to the more superficial aspects. But for some people, that's a good thing. All right, so if we were to now consider our circumstances and look at this from a, we'll say, holistic viewpoint. After death, changes in physics and life are important because they give us almost a certain superficial understanding that God exists and life has some greater meaning than what we expected. But it also robs from us the most critical elements of being able to create more in the most extreme of circumstances and to discover the real biggie things about God by helping us to create ourselves into more of that being while we're physically alive. So it is, it's a bitter pill. It isn't one thing, it's kind of both. It is a trade-off for those less enlightened. Moving on to the astral world probably helps them to develop a bit higher consciousness, which is the majority of people. But for those who are quite enlightened, leaving the physical world entails a loss of the hardest, most difficult parts of existence, but the greatest levels of growth in consciousness, in spirit, in beingness with our Creator. So relative to the consciousness of the person, the experiences they have in life and death are considerably different. That should be an interesting point. Okay, so going a little bit further with our great thinker Einstein, and this business of time. Time is probably as changed as about anything you can think of changing as soon as you move away from the physical dimension. Now, what goes on with time? Well, there is literally more than twice the amount of time in dimension, not in amount, that is available. So you have twice as much dimension to time. Time is considered by some people to be the fourth dimension. I'll call it the fifth. It really doesn't matter. But it is considered another dimension in physics. And it is so in metaphysics for the most part. So that being the case, having more time in a dimensional amount changes the relationship of things like how long it appears that time is available. The more time that is connected to space, the greater the amount of time that a person has available to them to live or to use, to exist within. The more the time is separated from space, as it is here in the physical world, the relative, remember the relativity issue, amount, less amount of time a person has by a significant amount. Depending upon where we are after physical death, the amount of time available, even though dimensionally it starts with about somewhere around twice as much, but it changes in terms of amount of time to the experience of the person by far more than that. So in the astral realm, you have anywhere from 3 times the amount of time to about 24 times the amount of time that a person has in relative terms here in the physical world. Well, having more time is kind of an interesting idea in itself. Then, in looking at it, if you go past the astral world to the monastic subworld, time can increase by at least up to 90 times more in terms of the amount of time that's available. And that's like four times greater than the greatest amount of time you could live in the monastic world. But what does that mean in reality? What are we talking about in an example term? Well, let's say that we live 10 years here. And someone who's living in the highest realm of time joined with space in the astral world is 24 times the amount of time for them, approximately. These are all approximate numbers. Then they would have a tremendous amount more time that they could live in 10 years. They would live approximately 240 years of time. Wow. Now, this has to do with a thing called time dilation, but it's a little more complicated than the time dilation caused by mass being present within a single dimension, as happens in the physical world and around a highly massive body. All that's doing is it's bending the space and causing time to alter due to that factor. But once you enter into a change in dimensionality, the quantum constant changes, and now you have a new kind of dilation of time in which literally the time is going much faster, effectively, not the time, but the speed of light, excuse me, is going much faster than it is here in the dense physical world, and that changes the relationship of mass to space. And as an effect of those constants, you end up with a dilation of time that changes time dramatically. Now, it does things that we are not familiar with in the physics of the physical world. One of the things that it does is it allows people to live longer, but they can observe us to some degree. We are moving much, much, much slower. Now, this confuses some people. They say, well, why aren't we moving faster? Well, because these other folks are living in a greater amount of time, but in relative terms to what we're doing, they're living out much more time than we are in the same amount of quote-unquote relative time. And so we don't seem to be doing much in the same period of time that they're doing something. And that's exactly what they see, if you understand what I'm saying. You can picture all that. Now, we can't observe them because they literally are moving too fast for us to even see if we could. And because in order to see them, we would have to have two bodies of ourselves, minimum, joined together to be able to do that, we wouldn't be a human being anymore by definition. So that would... There are some beings that are human that can do that, but we can't. Okay, because our senses are not developed so that we can observe more than one-dimensional aspect of the universe at a time. Ah, that's why. So, again, sense has a lot to do with this, and so does thought. Now, I hope I haven't confused you too much. I'm not going to go through the mathematics of everything I'm saying, but there is math that will support the explanations I'm talking about. It's just that you have to change the quantum constant in the speed of light if you're going to get these numbers right. Otherwise, you'll say, oh, well, what he's saying is not possible because... Well, it's only possible if you're willing to do that. If you're not willing to do that, well, then it won't work. And you would say everything I'm talking about is not possible to have happened. All right. So, after death, people move on to the astral subworld, one of them in particular. Although, if you live in a higher one, you can usually visit a lower one at will. But moving from... from a lower one to a higher one, you have pretty much the same kinds of problems that people from this world have in trying to live in the astral world and get very far with it, because your senses are usually not good enough and your thought is not high enough in consciousness to maintain full consciousness while you're in the astral world, unless you're in a lower sub-world. And as a result, people fall asleep instead of staying conscious, and they just come back to here. Same thing happens to people in the lower sub-worlds if they try to visit a higher one and can't maintain consciousness there. But people from the higher ones can go visit people in the lower ones if that's what they want to do. If they do it for the wrong reason, they'll lose consciousness, and maybe they won't be able to return. But if they do it for the reason of bringing enlightenment and helping to serve others spiritually, well then, yeah, that works fine. You can go do that. All right. What does this mean in bottom line situations? It means that once we die from the physical world, a whole new realm of physics is upon us. Even more than that, we're going to live in one of seven, predominantly, normally seven, subworlds of the astral plane, and the eighth is only for people who are objectively evil, and for the most part, most of them have lost their soul. So it's a giving them up. Lost is probably a kind term. At any rate, the most people are going to live in the astral world in a relatively, we'll say, comfortable and even more spiritual place of mind and soul, but not necessarily relative in consciousness any more than when they left the physical earth. And they're also going to lose some of their creative opportunities if they don't push themselves harder. And it's easy not to, because when folks get to the astral world, things are so much easier. Why break out of sweat? Heck, you can create almost anything with your imagination. You only use up a little bit of your sense every time you do it. It's not a big deal. Well, that's kind of true, except you live a lot longer. The average person is going to live like hundreds and hundreds to thousands plus years in the astral world of their time. And, you know, even though you're living a bit more spiritually than when you were physically alive, that's still a very long life, and things get used up like senses. And bodies are hard to maintain, even if they're a projection of your own imagination. You may have trouble keeping that imagination the way you'd like it to be. And so, inevitably, people find that unless they are in the afterworld for truly enlightened reasons, over time, their life diminishes. And the meaning they get from life tremendously diminishes for the average folk, even the ones who are, on an average, pretty good people. Well, that's something to consider, isn't it? And it's something to think about to the point where maybe we should go to a break, and when we come back, we'll deal with the more nitty-gritty aspects of what after-death changes in physics do for life, and for life, particularly in the astral world. I'll talk a little bit about the mental at the end of the show. So we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower, MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for a better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Yes, tonight we're talking about after-death changes in physics and in life. That sounds strange to some people. They're going to say, well, how the heck does this guy know anything about after-death? Well, without going into too much detail, I had out-of-body experiences with the help of a sensory isolation tank and eventually, because I had some background in physics at that time, and even more today possibly, I was able to figure out some of the changes in what we're talking about tonight in physics. And when I started to apply these in mathematical terms as well as in experiential terms, they two came together and supported each other. So that's what I did. It was pretty scientific in a sense, although certainly experiential, and it took years for me to put it all together and make experiments that would make sense in testing out certain ideas until I finally kind of got it. The big part of getting it was that this was all created by a being and not by some, we'll say, chance of nature because of the extremely narrow ranges in which each of the different parts of subdimensions and dimensions work within. There's no tolerances. The slightest change would cause what we consider to be life after death to not be able to be possible. And so, partly because of that reason, but even more so by the design itself. The design is made to help people become more conscious and more spiritual, not the reverse. And that's kind of what convinced me. Although the other thing is pretty important, too. Although people who are into chaos theory and things like that will just say, well, given enough chances, eventually we're going to... Yeah, I've heard that one before. Okay, so getting to the bottom line of where we're going to visit today, I'm trying to bring enough attention to what I'm going to be describing in experiential issues, bring enough attention in the science realm so that people can check it out for themselves. And if they can't check it out for themselves because they're not that familiar with science and math, then they can go to other people and say, hey, this guy came up with this idea. What if you change this and that? What would happen? All right. So you can do that. And that's what I like about this show, is that we try to get to truth. Truth is usually confirmed through mathematics in science and also through experiences, strangely, in physics. physics is not as much a mathematical science as people think, because a major part of physics is an observation and experimentation through that system, particularly if, strangely, you're into the standard model of physics, which I realize this dimensionality stuff puts a kind of a monkey wrench into, but not really. Not if you're truly a quantum physicist as well and you understand the processes involved in it. This should start making some sense to you. All right, let me go into the experiential changes now so that we can probably deal with most of the rest of the show from that viewpoint, although I may occasionally bring up something that's a little scientific here and there. All right, so what does this mean if you, when you die, when you die, your consciousness shifts focus from the senses in your physical and etheric or electromagnetic body. That's one body, kind of two parts to it. And, science recognizes there's an electromagnetic part of all physical or biological organisms, but doesn't use the same terminology. They won't call it this kind of energy or that kind of energy. They won't call it a chakra and this and so. But it doesn't really matter. There is this recognition, and it's certainly true as far as I'm concerned, and from both the experience and mathematics are very important about in that part of the realm. But I'm going to ignore the etheric or electromagnetic parts right now and just talk about the astral world, because this is where people are going to spend a good amount of time, a large amount of time. In comparison to here, in relative time, they would spend a lot of experiential time. And we, again, because the physics has changed, there's a lot more of time. The dimensionality of time is more than twofold, but it's greater than that. The actual amount of time is multiple, many times more than that, as I said, up to 24. So for every year that a person lives here in the physical world, someone in the astral world on an average will live 12, 15, up to 24 years. And they will continue to live there for 30 to 50 on an average of the years here. Okay, so you do the math, and that's a lot of years now. Now, it changes from person to person. There are rare people who spend almost no time in the astral world, even in their time frame, and others that spend a bit more than what I'm saying in terms of the 30 to 50 years. But it's pretty much in that realm. It's pretty much those are the averages. So a lot of people are going to say, well, I'm going to live there for 40 years, and I'm going to have a 15-to-1 time dilation. Okay, and that's going to give me 600 years of life in the astral world until the senses of the astral body diminish to the point where life cannot be sustained in. The person's creative imagination is limited by their sense, and then they can't create much, and a lot of other negative things happen, in which case the astral body is no longer suitable for life. And it literally dies, but a little differently than it does in the physical world, but it still dies. And then that person goes on and lives in the monastic world, the remaining body where they can focus their senses into before they rejoin themselves with their soul. Okay. And that's for almost everybody except for a few evil folks who are deciding not to go back to their soul. They want to destroy life and God and many other folks. They like power and control, and they'll do anything to have it and maintain it. All right, so for the rest of us, going to the astral world is a kind of new life. New kind of living. Literally, whatever a person desires becomes activated in their imagination, and through that activation of thought, we'll call it imaginative thought, whatever they picture becomes materialized from the energy, which turns into form, being following the thought of that person. Now, can collective people do this if their thoughts are very strongly together and they all think the same thing? Yeah, they can create things jointly together, and sometimes it's a lot easier. More often than not, the thought of others tends to diminish the creations of each individual, because the people being around things, they just, even though they may not in a deliberate fashion want to change that which is existent, may do so involuntarily and inadvertently, because they say, oh, well, you know, it would look a lot prettier like that. And next thing you know, their imagination's doing it. And the energy's following their thought instead of the thought of the last person who thought of it. So things can get pretty indefinite pretty quickly. And unless the person is fairly disciplined in the use of the creative imagination, it could become a kind of merry-go-round, constant changes from one place to the next, to the next, to the next. Because everybody wants their own thing. And they have different desires. Consequently, because of that nuisance, people of similar desires and similar abilities and imagination tend to gravitate together, meaning that similarity in consciousness becomes a very strong motivation for people to, literally, the correct word is in this case, is gravitate together to others like themselves. It makes life easier, and they get along better. So in the astral world, you find subworlds of people who have, we'll say, some common denominator of consciousness in which the amount of time that they separate from space compared to the amount they join is relatively similar to each other, and so they're about of equal levels of consciousness, creativity, lack of or amount of enlightenment, and a whole bunch of other, we'll say, corollaries that bring them into that joint opportunity. And they could live even together, somewhat separated from others, even in the same dimension. That will work, too, as long as they don't push on each other's space too much. Now, the astral world is huge compared to here, because the added dimension adds a lot more, well, what we would call space to it, and the results are that if people want to be pretty much away from other people, no problem. You can find some place to go in the astral world and certainly create it into what you want it to be without very many other people bothering you about doing it, because they may not even find you. It's almost impossible for people of lower consciousness to find people of significantly higher consciousness. Because the space and the way that people create in the dimensionality of that space, if they're more conscious, makes it invisible, literally, in a sense, kind of way, to those of significantly lower consciousness. So even within the same subdimension, folks are, we'll say, segregated by their consciousness. Those of higher, significantly higher levels of consciousness are away from and cannot easily be interfered with by those of lower consciousness, even though they exist in the same subworld. And between subworlds, this becomes even more extreme. So someone from a lower subworld has a very, very, very slight chance of being able to have much effect on someone in a higher subworld, because the dimensionality taxes their consciousness beyond the point where they can stay conscious. They literally fall asleep upon arrival, if they can even arrive, and they just have no possibility of even bothering anybody in the higher subworld. Actually, this, if you think about it, this makes every bit of sense. You would want to build a bunch of subworlds like this, because one, lesser people of consciousness have less of an effect on those with greater consciousness. Now, why is it that God wanted and chose to have the physical world, where we are, inhabited mostly by people of all kinds of consciousness, although, of course, in earlier times, you can geographically move someplace where people may not find it. But in general, you have a mishmash. And the reason for that is it's more challenging, and it allows people to overcome the challenge that other people may place upon them, wanting to upset their time and space that they're living in, and trying in many cases to literally, if they're evil, be destructive. So it gives you a better chance to understand how to fight, recognize and fight evil, by being physically alive in comparison to the astral. And it gives you a better chance in how to be creative outside of the box, so to speak, because you need to be if you're going to truly create much of a difference. So this is fascinating. And the folks that are in the astral world, some of them know this. They usually are found in what is known as the spiritual subworld, the second and first astral subworld. We are there's huge amounts more of time and the ability to be creative. And the main focus of people is on becoming more spiritual. The folks in the second subworld want to become more spiritual by perfecting the way that they love and do so in more wise ways. Whereas the folks in the first subworld are already subconsciously able to be wise lovers. That's not even a problem for most of them. Instead, they're trying to be equally creative as they are wise in giving. Whereas the folks in the second subworld are nowhere near that level of balance inside themselves. So they're not as enlightened, literally. But they have some level, and they have some level, significant level of consciousness, so it's a good thing. They just don't have it all together. All right, now, for most people, they're not going to go there. They're going to end up in probably the third, fourth, fifth subworlds. That's where most of the people who are probably listening to the show tonight will end up. Now, why do I say that? Well, people in the sixth and seventh subworlds are usually too selfish and aren't going to be interested in listening to some guy yak on the radio for 2.5 hours and talk about things that doesn't realize them some material return or give them more power and control and make themselves feel more important. So, that being the case, if they can't get those things, they're likely not going to be listening. And so that I don't mean anything to them. The stuff I'm saying is irrelevant. Okay, so getting now to the rest of folks who want to get more, we'll say, meaning in existence and meaning out of life, those people may be listening to the show, and in any case, the likelihood is they're going to go to the fourth or third subworlds and possibly as low as the fifth. Now, where is this fifth subworld? The fifth subworld is really very close to the way we think of physical Earth. It may be a little tiny bit more selfish in some strange ways because the people are willing to give up consciousness for ease of living. And that always ends up with some kind of significant compromise. Okay. It's still not the worst thing in the world. And they're not bad folks. They just aren't necessarily seeking to grow in consciousness. Whereas those on the fourth subworld are. It's a definite desire to at least look like they're becoming more conscious, and some of the time actually being so. So they really, really look for that. And those are kind of two different styles, let's say, of wanting to live, and two different reasons for life itself. All right, so after death changes are significant, to say the least, the way a person looks to others and to themselves, if they want to look at themselves that way, and most people do, is almost always a construct of themselves. It takes a lot of energy for someone to change the way someone else looks, tremendous amount of thought, and a lot of energy, and the results are seldom lasting. Most people don't even try to do that. But we create for ourselves the way we're going to appear, and most people make themselves a bit younger, more virile, or more beautiful. And these are common ways that people use their senses for what would be considered a selfish thing, for the most part. And depending upon how conscious they are, it can use up a lot of their resources of sense and imagination. Now, if you do it because you're serving others, and you just need to look good enough to serve them, then that's okay. Then you don't really go into a big negative pot. But if you go into the realm of, gee, I just want to be super hot. Look at me. I'm just great. The appearance of a person that can take a big toll on their senses, their thought in general. And so they pay a much higher price for that to occur. And this is common that people do. All right, well, is that such a bad thing? What is so terrible about that? Well, nothing in a sense. But remember, we've got to go back to what I stated in the first segment, and that is that this whole thing is created by God to help us to explore the meaning of life and what God's doing, for God's purpose, spirit itself, for us to become more spiritual, rejoin with our souls, and live a life more of our soul, to do a lot of great things. And this business of being soul controlled by your desires, and what you desire is ruling your life, becomes a nemesis for the folks who, over long periods of time, don't vary much from their selfish positions. They spend most of their time, literally, about themselves in some way and how they appear and look to other people. This is not a definitely good thing. It is, though, a kind of endemic thing to the astral world in general, and especially to a people in the fifth, fourth, even third subworlds, but somewhat for different reasons. And so the attitude of life in the astral world is that people become or get what they desire for most of their life. And most people consider receiving what they desire the definition of heaven. Hey, I get what I desire. How could that be such a bad thing? Well, the test is to give up your desires and to break through the ones that are fixed in you, sometimes called glamours, for the benefit of others so that they can grow as much or more than you can or are spiritual. In other words, they're going to get closer to their creator because you're giving up your desires for the benefit of a vast number of others. Well, that's a tough, tough thing for a lot of people to do. And it may take 20, 30, 40 astral years before people kind of get the idea about that. And even when they do, it doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily be very good at challenging that normality in their life. But people eventually do break through it, and many do. And they live a much more spiritual life. Very possible to do this. All right, well, that means that the first challenge that almost everybody has is to deal with these fixed desires that they've got inside them because they're so compelling. And if you're listening to the show, if you can remove or reduce the fixed desires while physically alive and before your death, it becomes much better for those people who do that after their physical world death. Their experience in the astral world is far more spiritual and enlightened, and they do not suffer most of the consequences of those who don't care about others the way I'm talking about. So, You got really a fascinating situation here because the choice is night and day. It's up to each of us. Some people get it. sometimes after they've lived in the astral world for dozens of years, and some people don't get it at all. So that's an interesting problem. Not to worry, even if you don't get it at all, eventually you will die from the astral world, you will live in the mental world, and get another shot at it, and ultimately you go back to being your soul anyway, and you can and then you choose to reincarnate. So it's not the worst thing, but it's a huge waste of resources, because every human being is a vast resource for co-creating with the Creator. And making this world and any other world that it has contact with a better place. So we have it. We've got that going for us. And we could be making that happen once we get to the astral world. Now, because there are physics changes, there's some things you can't do at all in the astral world. I was talking to some people about this in the last week or two. And you can't, as an example, create things without the assistance of others who know how to, that you've never had experience at creating at all, and have those things do anywhere near any element of, we'll say, a function. It might look kind of like what you want them to, but they won't function. Let me give you an example. Let's say that you want to create a musical sound from, quote-unquote, a musical instrument, and have the instrument have its own character, its own nature, and not just be an expression of your imagination and pretending to make the sound when the sound is coming from your own imagination. So in other words, the real, quote-unquote, instrument, although made out of astral energy, could replicate and become part of the sound of someone if they decided to let that happen. Well, that's pretty cool. I think that's good. The only problem is, if you've never created the instrument while you were physically alive, and you don't know anything about the instrument in terms of how it would sound if you did this or that or anything else, the creation of it in the astral world will not produce the same effects as you might want. It may look like a great saxophone. It may feel, in some respects, to the touch as a great saxophone. But when you play it, it may not make a single note. And even if it does, it may all be flat, sharp, or somewhere in between. That's the difference. You're not the person who creates saxophones while you're alive. And now you want to do so in the astral world. Instead of learning this yourself and being able to create it yourself, you now are at the mercy of the few people who might know something about saxophones. But worse than that, they may not be willing to use up their senses and their time to pay attention to this issue. So you've got a real interesting problem here. There's just so many things like this that we depend upon others to be involved in the creation of the form. But in the astral world, you're using creative imagination, and although a person can make the necessary changes so that they have it resemble what they want it to resemble, the bottom line is that it's not going to enrich their experience in playing it, because they aren't an expert in creating, either out of astral energy or any other kind of energy, a great saxophone or a great musical instrument. See, that's one example. There are a multitude of examples of things that people depend upon from others to have been created in the physical world that may not be readily available to them in the astral world. And please remember that many people go to the astral world, they may be great at making saxophones here, but they decide not to make them anymore. And they look into doing something else. Well, they're not there as a resource for someone to go in and have a new saxophone made by this great artist of musical makers. And so it just doesn't happen. Fascinating stuff. Really is. All right, so this leads us into a whole realm of desires. People have so many desires while they're physically alive that are unmet that they're compelled to try to keep getting that, they may spend 99% of their day following those fixed desires, sometimes called dreams, and not much time at all on trying to serve other people. That changes things, doesn't it? So part of this equation is best dealt with not when you go die. Once you die, it's very seductive and difficult to change what the outcome is going to be in the afterworld. The best time to change this is right now. While a person is physically alive, they have a better chance at dealing with these astral anomalies because most of their senses, over 80% of their senses, come from their physical body and senses and not from the astral or mental world. So the result is they are using those right now. They lose those senses when they go to the astral world. That makes it very difficult for them to even have a footing on anything I'm going to talk about. And so this is the time when they have the best chance of changing these glamours in themselves so that they are controlled by them when they go to the astral world. Does that make sense? It makes sense to me. Now, when people get bogged down and try to effectively make themselves a whatever it's going to be in the physical world, they can go to others to help them, but the help usually comes from a selfish vantage point. If they do it from the vantage point that everything they're doing is for the benefit in some way of others, then they are inoculating themselves against the loss of, we'll say, the ability to grow in the astral world. So the best time to deal with our desires, particularly if they're fixed within us, those are the ones that almost don't change. They just keep going on and on. We want. We may want more or something, but we keep wanting. And the addictions we have to that. The best time to deal with it is right here and now, especially with things that have become addictive. A person just has to keep getting more of them. And it is almost a necessity that we do it now so that we can fully enjoy and live the life that we're going to have in the astral world and grow closer to our soul in that process that's going to be uniquely different because the physics have changed. Yes, it'll be easier, but we may be ill-prepared because of what we're doing here and now. The more selfish a person is while they physically live, the more they will lack meaning in their life, astrally and especially mentally, when they get to those worlds. So it's not a punishment. It's a result of their own doing. It's just the way it works. Not meant to be like, oh, that'll fix them because they're going to be punished. No, it's just a result of your own doing. All right, so can we get to this reality while we're physically alive? Because after all, we're more illusioned here. Our senses don't work very well, and we're overwhelmed with energy that absolutely does not want to follow our thoughts. So we can't just imagine something and have it pop up and say, well, here it is. That's all true. But what we can be is more creative, operating within greater levels of choices, provided the society we live in gives us some opportunity to do that. And in addition, use the enlightenment aspect to raise consciousness within ourselves so we become greater in wise giving. And so the things that we're actually creating are for the benefit of others to wisely give to them. That doesn't mean we don't enjoy something from what we create. We do by gaining meaning in our life here and now, right now. At the same time, we don't have things that may be truly at our disposal to use anytime we want, and we don't have the power and control over others we may seek by having things or material wealth of some sort. And we will find ourselves in a process in which we make more errors than, we'll say, usual, because we're challenging our own abilities to be creative. But the errors are for the benefit of others, and those kind of errors almost always lead to truth eventually and to correction of the same errors. So it's a kind of almost, in the beginning it may seem like, oh gee, I'm going to screw this up and what am I going to do now? But in the long run, it's the way to maximally grow while we're physically alive. And isn't that what most people want? I would think so, yes. Because this maximum growth gives us such incredible levels that we can do something about right here and right now. Okay, what are some of the other things that change when you get to the master world besides the concept of form? Well, the biggest change for a lot of people is love. I talked about wise giving as being a big way to learn. The other thing that's so big is empathy and something called super empathy. Empathy is the ability to know how other people are feeling in themselves about the mundane elements of their existence. Super empathy tells you how other people feel in terms of their sense of a co-creation with God. When you put the two together, you get a great understanding of the world. When separated, regular empathy does not give someone the ultimate understanding what they really need to have of spirit in others and how people are or are not being spiritual and how ultimately they are or not being spiritual. And then when you get into situations of love, that is where it is most important, no matter whether it's romantic love or parental love or any kind of love, which is giving, of course, where the wisdom of giving includes giving people the needed tools, the things that will help them to help give back to God and help give to everyone else so they are more eager to and find it easier to co-create with God or the Creator. That's the way the system is supposed to work, and there are many ways to encourage that process. But that's what we're aiming for, particularly in the astral part of the universe. All right, well, that doesn't sound too bad, right? And if life truly becomes more meaningful, which it does, then why not pursue it? Well, it gets tricky because people are easily seduced into a life of ease and without having to question themselves very much about how or what they're doing. And also, in a romantic sense, it's easier to have strong feelings for a person, which in some ways are genuine feelings of affection and love, than in the physical world. Easier to have those feelings. The part that's difficult, though, is it becomes difficult to have those feelings more than on what I would call a moderately superficial level. Somewhat deeper than just superficial, but not really deep. So the deepest kinds of love escape people. In the astral world, it's the world where people have feelings and love should be a big deal, right? But remember I said at the beginning of the show, the superficial dominance. It seduces people away from the deeper experiences in life. Wow, what does that mean? Well, you're going to live a long time. And if you only have superficial feelings for the people that are your friends, lovers, associates, family, people don't maintain anything more than a moderate level of superficiality in those relationships. They may keep them around for a long time, but they're not very deep. Oh, Then you get into serial issues of love, where people are going from one person to the next to experience some realm of love with them in various different ways. And then moving on to another person, without it being deep enough for it to maintain itself for the rest of that person's existence, both astrally and mentally, much less even part of their existence, astrally. And so this becomes almost a way of life. People moving from one person to the next, people not having a core inside of them, which we'll call the soul, that is the main way that they operate from. And this is true of people who live in anything other than the spiritual subplanes of the astral world. It's true, for the most part, of most of the people who live in the astral world today, and has been for years. So we've got this quagmire of the thing that's so important to people. I mean, we talk about love all the time here. As in the world where it should be a big deal, and people really get it. Okay, yeah, love is what it's all about. It becomes moderately superficial because of the ease to which a person can find, interact with, have time to, and without much difficulty progress with others in feeling love, exchanging love, and interacting with love, but at the same time, not very deeply. Now, am I saying this because the science supports it? Well, yeah, but that's not... I'm saying it because that's what I experienced. And for most of the time that I was going to the astral world, I was only involved with people who were in the non-spiritual subworld. And so I saw a lot of this stuff going on. And it dismayed me. And until I started figuring out why this was the case, I was despondent. Because it seemed like, gee, this is what awaits me. It isn't real heaven, is it? Yes, you get whatever you desire, as long as your desire isn't to be truly a spiritual being, a soul. And then in that case, you can't get what you desire by seeking it or desiring. You get it by service and by co-service with others and with God. Then it all works out, sure. But if you don't do that, and you get confused, or someone gets, you're not interacting in ways that you figure this thing out, the results can be pretty bad. Yeah. I would say more than moderately unhappy, even though things are moderately superficial. All right, so unhappiness becomes, or we'll say a lack of meaning, becomes a big problem for a lot of folks. And I discovered this pretty early on in my experiences. I didn't understand it until I began to put two and two together and saw the real purpose behind it all. Because in the beginning, I was confused by it more than annoyed by it. Okay, so preparing ourselves before physical death for these kinds of issues becomes important, to say the least, because once we get there, the seductive elements of our own desires will sabotage us away from having a meaningful life. And we'll segregate ourselves to live with people with similar consciousness, so we won't even be able to see the ways out of it. That's not a good thing. What about things like children? Well, children are pretty important because you can't have a child through birth in the astral world. You can only adopt the ones who die from the physical world while they're children. And those children need special attention, even if they're going to a lower subworld. Because, or maybe even more so if they're willing to allow suffering. Because they have low consciousness if that's the case, but they need constant attention and help. Some people see this and don't want the people in the lower subgroup to bring these kids up, so they go, and they will spend a considerable amount of time in the lower subgroup. They can't bring the kid with them because they fall asleep, and they go right back. They just disappear from there and go back to the subgroup that they came from. But they'll spend time to raise their consciousness. They get some help from people from the spiritual subworld, the two spiritual subworlds, to do this because they don't understand the whole thing. And eventually, they actually bring the kids to the subworld they came from, maybe the fourth or fifth subworld, or maybe the third, because they want to have children. And this is a great love, an act of love. And they do a world of good for those that they bring to this level of consciousness. A lot of the children, therefore, don't stay in the sixth and seventh subworlds where it's atrocious for them, really. There's a lack of children there because the folks in the higher subworlds couldn't snatch them up eventually. But remember the great sacrifice to be made, because they have to live in these lower subworlds for protracted periods of time trying to raise the consciousness of these children. And you may find yourself choosing to do that because you want to have a child or because maybe someone else needs you as a parent. Strangely, folks from the higher subworlds, as well as your own solar angel, may intervene and say, hey, look, we need you, so will you do this for us? So adoption can be encouraged from higher sources to help the children who have a much more difficult time in the astral world. First of all, they died quite early in the physical world. They have, even if they didn't like their parents, sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. But they have their parents left behind and others and old friends. And they're ill-prepared. And if they're lower in consciousness because they were brought up that way, of course, then they need considerable help. It's not an easy thing. I will tell you, you may choose to do it. Even though right now you say, well, I never do that. It's too hard. Well, people do it there. And there isn't a huge number of children without people who want to parent them. I'll tell you that. Almost all of them want. They find many people who want to be their parents. Then it's up to the child. Isn't that different? Yeah, it's up to the kid. You can't be a parent to a child unless the child desires it. Otherwise, your own senses will diminish so quickly from being in conflict with the child, you'll become an idiot long before the child will grow up. Wow. And children grow more slowly there in the lower subworlds below the spiritual ones. So it takes longer, and it's a greater commitment to raise them. Partly because of this problem when you're dying when you're a child, it's so difficult to adjust to a whole other dimension of time and space. You know, they're having a hard enough time usually whether physically or not. Sudden death among children is also a radical problem. And requires even more loving, wise loving, on the part of those that intervene. Some people choose to be distant parents while being the local parent. That they want to help a number of children, and they sort of like being uncles or aunts or something like that. But they're pretty much trying to do this because they recognize how hard it is to be a parent, and that usually the parents who are doing it need more assistance than they do in the physical world. It's a tough job. Now, the good news about this is that it challenges people to become wise givers. It's more important in the astral world for children to help them become wise givers than in the physical world. In the physical world, they can teach themselves somewhat. The astral world, no such thing. They can skate by if they want to. And you need to take a stronger hand in helping them. You know that, right? Yeah, I know. Okay, yeah, everybody thinks, oh, it's so much easier. Why should children have to worry about anything? Well, it's actually not so much easier for kids who die within 5 or 10 years, 15, of living in the physical world. They have all kinds of issues. All right. And remember, even if they didn't like them in some circumstances, siblings and parents behind. Okay, so how is it that this challenges people? Well, you know, the challenge almost always is to become more aware and more co-creative with God. The process is never easy, but sometimes it's greatly rewarding. And so that's, I think, the bottom line is that if you're going to be looking for an easy time of it, don't die from here, because it'll be easier here in some respects than it might be in the astral world. Even though people say, well, but isn't it like going to heaven? You got anything you desire? Isn't that what heaven is about? Well, not really. I mean, the real concept of heaven is being one with God, and God is a great creator, so you have to become one yourself. And being one with God also means God is a great wise giver, and you've got to become one of those. And God is a great, great user of energy in the most efficient of ways, and lacking anything other than intelligent responses with other people. And communicates perfectly. Well, that's all great, but you've got to become more of that. If in the astral world, you expect it to be a very meaningful way for yourself. And a lot of people think differently until they get there and they experience what I'm telling you, and then they say, "Whoa, how come nobody ever told me about this?" Well, of course, they probably didn't listen to the show or read some of the books or anything I've done, but there's other people who have written about this too, so they can get it from different sources. However, it's because most people are afraid to think of death. A number of people don't believe that death, there's life after death. And those same people oftentimes have trouble believing in God. So you got both of those going together, producing some very strong, we'll say, difficult issues. Going on to the astral world is it can be second nature, you just go with the flow, or it can be a very insightful, tremendously helpful to yourself and mostly others experience in which the joy of giving wisely becomes a foundation for existence. Preparing yourself to do that here gives you the best chance for doing it on your own side. Really. Now, what about those who are atheists? I don't know how many of those are listening to the show tonight, but let's put it in this perspective. If you don't believe in God, then the question is, what do you believe in? Well, for a lot of them, they're humanists. They believe that humanity has its own importance. Okay. We can start with that. But then you don't believe in life after death, so then your life ends when you die from the physical world. One would assume that's when the end of life is. And underneath that, there's a frightening proposition, because the physical body dying is no big deal, but the death of consciousness is horrendously disturbing. And I don't care how intellectualized the person is. I don't care how they say they've adjusted to that concept. They're scared out of their minds about it. Underneath them all. It's this fundamental fear that causes many people who are atheists to become overly controlling and try to get something out of life that they've lost in not having faith. And beyond faith, not having enough understanding of faith and of God to think that life could or should or does exist after death. But the fear of losing one's self completely, not existing, is a fundamentally terrifying because if existence ceases, the idea, well, I'm not in pain anymore. I don't have to worry about this or that. I'm just not here. What's the big problem? Well, the big problem is that it's the continuity of consciousness that makes all meaning in existence relevant. When that continuity is dissolved, because we're no longer existence, the meaning of all prior parts of life becomes hollow and without significant merit. To people in that perspective, they have to repress it and deny it in order to live each day with any semblance of normality. And yet, the denial and the repression causes them to become over-controlling, to have acting out personality problems that may turn into personality disorders, to seek escapes like drugs, including alcohol, and to seek life experiences that are exciting but yet superficial to help them to forget that the real meaning they're denying themselves by being an atheist and believing there is no life after death. This produces this tragic reduction in consciousness. That's what it does, which causes suffering. Now, I know you may have trouble understanding this part, but the suffering is really about not having meaning. That's what it's about. When we say when you lose consciousness, you suffer. Well, it's because you lose meaning from the loss of consciousness. And a lot of people say, well, how can I lose the meaning? I already had the meaning. So I'm going to die and things are just going to end. But it's the continuity of consciousness that goes backwards in time, making everything that seemed meaningful remain meaningful. And human beings are given two senses and enough consciousness to use them so that they suffer when they don't. Animals, unless they're around people and trained by people, don't. So they don't have to suffer by loss of consciousness or even by loss of physical life. Although they still have a fear of death. But the point is that humans suffer so immensely because they have two senses that constantly tell them that they're wrong. Constantly. That they're wrong about their atheistic viewpoints, and yet they choose and to intellectualize that into a statement, well, there's no need for God. And again, it's circular because the reason they believe there's no need for God is they deny and repress the suffering that they're having from that position. I know, I said a mouthful there. People are going, what is he doing? I was like, that super psychology. Yeah, I know. But you can re-listen to the show. It's like a half an answer. All right, so how do we get around this? What is the answer for those that seek the atheistic viewpoint and may be plagued by personality problems because of it and other issues and be suffering subconsciously or consciously but not letting them know about it? From a lack of meaning in their life. Well, the answer is to, strangely, to use the two senses that you're denying and use it while you're physically alive now so that you prepare yourself for your future life in the afterworld, plus to use your intelligence, your intellect, and your thoughts to question using principles in what I teach, which is ageless wisdom, to find the truth through that process rather than to adopt the truth because of a certain egotistical viewpoint that because haven't to this point figured out how God makes a difference, you have concluded you don't need God. But there's a lot to be done to get to that point. You've got to do some literal soul searching. You need to do some reflection on your own life and how you are living and what you're getting out of it and what you would desire. And the desire for an existence beyond the physical world comes into play into tonight's show. So, yes, this show is still for atheists, which is where we started 10 or 15 minutes ago about this subject. But it's for those atheists who are still listening, and it is for them to get to the point before they die to recognize that their own egotism is blocking them from seeing other alternatives. And their egotism may be, quote-unquote, some, I call it pseudo-scientific viewpoints, well, evolution just eliminates God completely, all this other stuff. If you do further study, you will not find it to be true. Not that there's no such thing as evolution, but it makes God even more a part of the picture if you have enough understanding of it, that's all. You just have to see that yourself. Why is it so important, if you're going to go on and live in the astral world no matter what, and you're an atheist, to even concern yourself with it? All right, you ready for this one? It's going to bother you the heck. In general, people who are atheists can never get beyond the fifth astral subworld. Some of them do get to the fifth, and that's okay with them, I guess. But the majority of them find themselves trapped in two different models. One is they live their life for the experience of the moment, which puts them into the sixth subworld, and there it's a miserable place to be. And or they become highly materialistic, and they might end up in the seventh subworld, or and probably at least an equal number of times later go to the fifth subworld, where they, yeah, okay, now they know there's life after death, but they still don't believe there's necessarily a God, just a system that somehow developed that does all this stuff and et cetera. That some of them get into that, and others find, well, okay, there's a God, but I really can't understand this God, and it seems to be strange that I'm living in this weird world. All of those potential outcomes are not great. This subworld's probably a better outcome than the sixth or seventh, but they all have within them a relatively negative experience for an atheist. Different from when they're in the physical world where they can just deny, deny, deny their own astral spiritual senses, the heart and crown senses. They can't do that anymore. So now they're plagued by the fact that they continuously have a sense of a greater magnitude to some extent in the astral world that tells them God maybe does exist, and there's a lot more conflict. The conflict is, well, I had already figured I was going to die, and that would be it. And now I'm here, so what do I do about it? I can't even begin to tell you the number of people I met with in that capacity in these subworlds. And the grief that they seem to experience is so much greater than the people who had at least a spiritual life and believed that God existed, and they didn't know exactly how, or maybe they had a religious view, or maybe they had some other thing. But those people are more open to growth and have a great deal more meaning in their life almost as soon as they get to the astral world than the folks who are the atheists. And so it's like condemning yourself to a really rough time if you have this problem. Now, what do I also suggest? Well, listen, if you're listening to the show, why not get the book I wrote, Life and Meaning, the textbook, read that, and see if that doesn't help you say, well, maybe this thing about God could be maybe it's not as crazy as it will seem. Maybe there is a reason for this. And we need to examine it. We need to be more, I need to be more open. You know, that's what you're saying to yourself. Again, you want to, if you're an atheist, you want to change that viewpoint before dying and going to the afterworld, although you're certainly going to change it anyway. It's just that the suffering will be more intense. And it isn't going to be as great a life, especially the first decade, can be pretty miserable. Pretty miserable. Now, what happens if you have a very strong religious viewpoint? And God is a certain way based upon what you were taught and all this stuff, and now you go to the afterworld, and it doesn't bear out to be true. I mean, the stuff your religion taught you didn't square with what you experienced. That can be a problem, too. It's a different problem than the atheist, but it's a problem nonetheless. So changing yourself for that kind of life usually means opening yourself in open-mindedness, but in heart as well, to the idea that every religion is formulated by human beings. And no, God didn't actually come here and create your religion. Humans created it in the best way they could sense of what they experienced about God. Well, what about Buddha? What about Jesus? What about Muhammad, the prophet? What about the great Jewish prophet? What about those that taught us over time so much? Moses, the lawgiver. Karash, possibly the greatest monarch or whatever you want to call him, the emperor, in all time, and maybe the most enlightened ruler of all time in any kind of system of politics. Karash is the second, is probably, and some people call him Cyrus the second, a great, great person who believed strongly in God, but helped other people to have freedom in thought and religion. Okay, so all of this together suggests that religion is a means to an end. It shouldn't be a life exclusive to the religion itself. But I know that that's what most religions try to teach, and many people want to believe. That will be shaken in a strong and maybe not so friendly way. And there are some sects of people who try to keep their religion in the astral world. But almost exclusively, this is true in the lowest of the astral world, or some world, the fifth, sixth, and seventh, and not beyond. Why not? Because there's too much contradiction that's right in your face. The elements of each religion do not adequately represent God. They don't explain God. They have some falsities in their conclusions about God, and maybe even who and what God is. And this leads to a period of alienation for a lot of people. So it's a problem. Sometimes the most religious people have a very hard time in first arriving in the astral world. They may be great spiritual people who do have done great things in their life, but they can't reconcile their religious foundations with the reality of the existence of their world. And they start to have depressions and serious problems about and suffering about God. And who and what God is. If you're more open-minded, you should learn about a lot of different religions, look into what's the best in each, and try to adopt some of that outside of just your own religion. I'm not saying you should, necessarily throw it in the faces of all the people that you congregate with in your religion. That may not be the best social way of approaching the situation. However, on an internal one, you can stay in the religion but modify your thoughts and maybe still be able to find a way of existing in both possible ways. If not, maybe the better thing is to change religion or to become more spiritual but less of a specific religious view. Those are all things to consider. In all of these circumstances, the most critical element is to be able to get closer to God. And religions are supposed to do that, but they more often than not become obstacles in the astral world. That's almost a certain truism. So be aware of that, because you're headed there. We're all going there, let's face it. And it's going to be difficult for some to make this adjustment, because the life there is so much changed by the physics, and you can't get around it. It's in your face, literally. Here, you can ignore a lot of stuff, because we're so much in illusion. You know, you don't believe one thing or another, what is it going to really matter? You're so confused about what the real reality of existence is. You know, why worry about the few things you can't square? But in the astral world, it's a totally different thing. It doesn't work like that. It is in your face, and you can't ignore it. Yeah. Okay, and what about romantic love? Let's talk about that for a bit. As I said, people have trouble maintaining the kind of passions and the desire to be intimately connected with someone in the astral world if they don't have as strong a connection, a similar and just as strong a connection with God. And this is why the relationships that last the longest, if not almost always last for a very long time, the ones that happen in the spiritual subworlds, the first and second spiritual subworlds, which is, has to do with the type of energy that's more predominant there, first and second ray energies. But the point is that most people don't live there. Most people live in a realm in which it is difficult to maintain the intimacy because it requires a level of understanding that involves a thing called super empathy. You can't just have empathy as you can in the physical world and maintain a relationship as people do here for 40, 50, 60 years or more. Here, they get away with it because regular empathy is sufficient to maintain that kind of relationship. But you get into the hundreds of years, and there's much more of reality that is in conflict with just empathy, that if you don't use super empathy, which means that you understand how the other person is becoming more like God and vice versa and with everyone else as well, then life takes on a totally different meaning, because now you're living a co-spiritual life with the person that you're intimate with, and you're also living to become more of each other, which is becoming more of God at the same time. It's a mouthful, I know. And the nature of the relationship shifts from one of, we'll say, intoxication and involvement with each other to spiritual service that is shared. Yes, you can still be very close, closer than ever with the other person. That's not the issue. It's the bottom line motivation behind the relationship, in which the service, the spiritual service, becomes the highest order, the highest moral values, that removes the doldrums, takes away the superficial, and prevents these people from distancing themselves or finding a lack of meaning in their relationship together. That's the difference. Now, why can't people do that in the physical world? Well, they sure can. The only reason they don't is because of laziness. Because, well, you've got to develop super empathy. And you've got to be in spiritual service. And that's so hard to do in the physical world. People are too selfish for that. Because because of their own selfishness, they won't develop that kind of relationship with God, much less another human being. But yes, the answer is clear. Do it here first. Do it here now. Then when you go over to the other side, no problem. It just continues. What if you die at different times? Well, you can read the novel I wrote, ostensibly a novel in any case, called Afterlife Love. Yeah, there's some real issues about that. Because you're in different time, relative time dilations. The person in the astral world is living an enormously expanded amount of time in comparison to the person living in the physical world. They're not in the same time. Now, normally we don't consider that to be such a big problem. But the only way you can maintain a relationship is by co-serving in some ways that overlap even between the two worlds. You're co-serving in ways that may involve some things that actually are beyond just the realm you're working in. That is one way, and it's the basis for afterlife love, of doing it. Certainly, if you're at least spiritually serving in huge amounts of ways, the relationship can survive, not necessarily without some sacrifice and difficulties on each person's part, but for hundreds of years, you may be separated and still be able to survive the time barrier when you come back to them. And that's asking for much more than most people can handle in the physical world at this time. Or for those living out of the spiritual subworlds, in the astral world, almost any time. You see, this is the differences. We need to face them. Therefore, people who are of more, we'll call it, the average of consciousness in terms of givingness, lovingness, wise-giving, enlightenment, and if they die by any significant difference in time periods from each other, their relationship will not go on. They will be with other people. This is normal and to be expected. Matter of fact, if you think about it, it's what they say, till death do you part. Well, why do they say that when you get married? Well, it's because there's no answer for most people with that quagmire. So you have to literally have that agreement, or else they would suffer because they can't withhold or can't maintain it. Either one, going on to live in another dimension or the one who stays here for a while. Now, how soon does the person, usually within the year or two at most, if they don't die within that period of speculative time, they will be separated by the time itself. Now, I'm not saying people who stay over here should kill themselves so they can be with their dearly departed one. That would make no sense either, because this is the place where you can grow the most and create the most for the world in general. And I say world, I'm talking about all aspects of God and throughout all the dimensions of time and space. You can do the most actually here, so to give up your life for something that is important but not should not be the number one element in your choice is a very selfish choice, which will have negative connotations, both on your relationship, potentially, with the other person, but also on yourself as well. Not a good idea. Don't do it. I know that that has entered into many people's thoughts when they lose a loved one. Even if it's a child, sometimes people feel that way, but certainly if it's an intimate lover, they want to go. Sometimes if it's their very best friends. These are unfortunate elements of our existence. We can get over them by having a strong, strong understanding of God and recognizing continuity of consciousness and recognizing we're all going to meet up as souls and we'll be together again someday. That's right, that the someday may be a lot longer than you realize. So it's not that it's impossible, but it's difficult. I know, it's very difficult. There's also karmic issues involved, and you don't want to try to argue with those. They get strongly in the way if you try. All right, so how does this shake out in terms of the other elements of life that we need to think about in the astral world that are different? Well, astral life has with it a stronger sense of its correlation to the higher spheres of, we call it the intuitional realm, of beauty. So people tend to focus more on things being beautiful, especially if they live in the fifth or higher subworld. Now, beauty in itself preserves sense, and it gives people a longer life. So it's no small thing. If you preserve life, that beauty is a very big virtue. Beauty is the greatest way to preserve life, so it's obviously a great virtue to have. Why is it better and easier to create beauty in the astral world? Because in the physical world, to create beauty, you have the resistance of inertia. Energy that is uglified by darkness is very difficult to change. It takes enormous effort. The good news is that in the astral world, it takes minimal effort to change very ugly things into reasonably beautiful things. And so that's a tremendous advantage, and it can preserve senses in yourself and mostly in others by doing it. So there's a great advantage there. And life changes to become more beautiful depending upon how high of a consciousness you develop. You get into any of the higher realms, and the preservation of life through beauty is an amazing part of the advantages of astral life. It's wonderful. It can be beauty in music, art. It can be beauty in movement. It can be beauty in structure of the environment. It can be beauty in interactions with others, including plants and animals. There's so much that of beauty that can be created and done so in a more efficient way than here in the physical world. And if it takes so little sense to improve beauty, and therefore to improve senses, a great deal of remedial kinds of things can be done by those higher in consciousness for those who are lower in consciousness. The only thing I warn you about, and I saw this happen so many times, is that sometimes people come and serve in higher consciousness, they make things more beautiful. And the folks they're doing it for, they're not as wise at giving as they should be, and the folks they're doing it for just destroy it, like, almost overnight, and you're right back where you started from, and you wonder why the heck you ever did that one. Well, you usually learn in a couple of times that that's not the wise kind of giving you're supposed to do. Yes, you're supposed to make things beautiful, but not for people who are going to destroy them. So the first thing is to see the people that you're doing it for and make sure that they are the ones who will, at least as best as they can, preserve it. Beauty is not best preserved, but it's best attitude. So that's another factor. Helping people to create a bit more of the beauty that you give them is the best way to actually preserve it. But that takes more effort than just creating the beauty in the first place. And it takes a required spiritual discipline, oftentimes leading to extended periods of being away from family and friends to accomplish this in other lower dimensions in time and space than where you might live. Again, it's like raising children. So it has that component to it. And that leads us into another area I wanted to bring into, that you need spiritual discipline more in the astral world than the physical. Now, why is that? Because the astral world is so easily changed. If you're not spiritually disciplined, you're going to do negative things even without, you know, wanting to. I mean, just by almost a whim of thought. Here, in the physical world, you almost have to be a lot more deliberate to change anything, good or bad. So the chances of seriously doing some damage here is limited by the inertial forces. Those are missing almost non-existent in the astral subworld. And so the chances are that you'll screw up and make something ugly that was really beautiful, and then you may not be able to turn it back. That's a tough thing. It's a real tough thing. And the more you make something ugly, the more your senses diminish as a result of it, and use of your own energies and forces against the thing that was beautiful, plus the thing that's beautiful is no longer helping you anymore when you destroy it, and you can't replace it. You have to get somebody to help you do that. And you can see that that's a real problem. Again, these things are mostly absent in the physical world. Mostly absent. Because it really takes a great effort to make things terribly ugly. Although people do it all the time. I don't care if it's graffiti or just plain making relationships ugly with people. But the point is that here, others get wind of it. They have more of a chance to be able to do something about it before it's, say, very far down the line. The astral world can be almost immediate. It happens too quick for anybody to change it, even with the great communication that goes on there. Things can be changed far too fast. And the amount of sad circumstances that come from it is disproportional to the amount of time it takes to do it. Okay, so when we look at another factor in the change in life in the astral world, it's possible for people to stay in touch with each other over very, very far distances, meaning that the interrelationships of family, friends, lovers, intimates, partners can be carried out over vast periods of time and space. Interdimensionally, it is more difficult. You can send a kind of message to each other, but it's harder to fully communicate back and forth. It's easier if you're in the same dimension of time and space. But in either case, you can do things that are absolutely remarkable. Now, we're slowly, technologically, kind of getting our cell phones and Skype and this and that. But it's nowhere near the astral, because in the astral, it's not just words. You get the person's feelings, their imaginative thoughts, even a sense of presence of them being with you when they communicate, even over very long distances. This is a tremendous advantage. And life changes because of this. It's like cell phones on steroids. You're into a totally different perspective of, we'll say, what it means to be apart. You're not really apart because you're able to connect through your astral bodies amazing distances, and especially if you're in the same subdimension. If you're in different subdimensions, it's more difficult, and particularly if it's more than one or so subdimensions apart, then it becomes the bare bones. It's more like a cell phone. But if it's within the same, it truly is remarkable how life changes just by that one element of existence. Again, the physics. Because you're living in a more multidimensional issue, you can be close to people just by how you and they feel. And the closeness connects through love. And then they can feel how you feel how they feel. They can experience your creative imagination. They will experience theirs. You can hear some of their mental thoughts. They can hear some of yours. You can also experience all the rest of their astral senses. Now, astral senses are more complete. They're more in-depth than the senses we have in the physical world. And by being able to sense what another person is sensing astrally, whoa, tremendous amounts of information. And if you can include, again, that element of the super empathy, that's all the senses together at the same time, including the two about God, you maintain a closeness of relationship with your friends, neighbors, anybody you want to call, because of that great ability. Now, some of you will say, oh, well, I want my privacy. I don't want anybody to be able to do that. If you don't want people to do that with you, you have even greater ability to block it than you would in the physical world, in a sense. So it's amazing. You've got both sides. If you want privacy, you can have very big privacy in a sense. But you cannot completely eliminate your own existence, so to speak, from someone who has higher consciousness than you and wants to find. But they would normally exist in a higher realm, and people aren't usually intervening and intruding on the consciousness of others, unless there's an extremely good purpose in it. If they have higher consciousness than people have lower, they don't usually intrude. That's not the normal way of functioning for people. Now, there are sure going to be some exceptions to what I'm talking about, but the normal way is not that normal. All right, so, wow, this opens up a whole realm of interesting life experiences, because now you start living some of the life of others, particularly others that you're close with in some way, who are willing to share their consciousness with you. And you start having new kinds of experiences. Your growth of consciousness now becomes multiplied by these changes in physics and by your interaction with other people because of beauty and because of the sharing of senses that people can do in the astral world. You can change your senses and share your senses in ways that are just remarkable. I'll give you an example, a very easy one. If you want to see yourself, you can look at yourself from outside of yourself. You can also do the same with other people who aren't even 1,000 miles or even close to you. I mean, you can do this in amazing, amazing things. All that contributes to the development of consciousness when done for the sake of growing more of God. And that's the secret. If you don't do it for that sake, you may develop more empathy, but not super empathy, and your senses will become diminished, and you will suffer some consequences of it, even though you may grow in certain ways. You won't grow evenly, and the part of you that's God will not grow evenly. It will be diminished. Okay, so this is pretty important, because now we have a whole other model for life than what we're used to. We are very, very segregated and separate from everybody else, and therefore very alone and lonely for the most part while living in the physical world. Good news. As long as you live above the sixth subworld, the amount of loneliness goes way down, and people do a lot better, provided they don't have some contentious issue about God, and that's why I talked about the religious problems that people can have. You don't have a contentious issue about God, and you're together on that with others, you're going to be far less lonely while living in the astral world than you were here. Now, that may frighten some people while they're here, because in odd ways, people here, they rationalize their senses of loneliness as being a way they can be with themselves. But at the same time, they are suffering underneath it because they are incredibly lonely, even if they're with their most intimate friends and lovers or lover. And the reason for that is that they cannot separate the differences and relish in them of being group conscious or soul conscious with their individual consciousness while they're physically alive. Because there's so much an illusion, they don't recognize soul consciousness. So the rationalization is a whitewash over their lack of group consciousness and allows them to feel better about lacking that issue. And then they can rationalize and say, well, it's okay, I like to be alone anyway. In the astral world, that's mostly resolved, except for the people who live in the seventh and sixth subworlds. But it's mostly resolved, and the people who are living in the fifth, the fourth, third subworlds, and especially the spiritual subworlds, have this amazing freedom of not being lonely, yet having as much time as they want to be alone, if that's what they choose, without it being a conflict with their soul. they are completely aware of the difference between individuality. I shouldn't say they're completely, but they're significantly aware of the differences between their existence in individuality and their existence in soul consciousness. And they can live both ways without it being a conflict, without them having to rationalize either one. This is generally a true statement, and it's one of the big factors that makes the astral world a very interesting place to at least visit. It is not the panacea that it is painted to be, and most people, when they go to the astral world, don't even experience much other than the six or seven subworlds, which are pretty harsh, and they don't have most of the things I'm saying. So they would be disillusioned. They might even think, well, if this is heaven, I'm not interested. Well, it's not where they're probably going to end up, but it is where the more selfish people tend to gravitate to. Because of that, their existence in life is far less meaningful, much more miserable, and yeah, sometimes they're very lonely. Not to mention all the other problems that they have. Okay, now let's deal with some of these basic questions people have. To me, they say, okay, I kind of got some of the stuff you said. I read the Afterlife Love book you wrote. I read the Rights and Meaning. Maybe they read some articles. And so they come to the conclusion now, and they listen to a lot of these shows. Well, okay, astral life isn't too bad. What's so great about it? If all the things you balance all this out, I mean, to some good things, not so much good things. What's so great about astral life? I mean, it's like, you know, I'm going to be there for hundreds of years. I'm going to be tired of it, be bored. It's just, who wants to live that long? I've heard that so many times. Who wants to live 500 years or something in one world or something? Well, this is the important element. The amount of time you live in the astral world is relative to the experience you have of growth of your higher self and of being part of God with some other people doing the same thing all together usually. And this becomes the denominator that you divide into the question of years and how long you're going to be there. The other thing to consider is what's so great about the astral world is that even though, and I have said this many times, even though it's an interim travel between here and the mental world, where I think it's an even better place to be existent, the advantages in the astral world are profoundly important if they're fully ventured into. So the benefits lead through your whole next life at least. And you get to correct so many things that you did wrong while you're physically alive, although you can't create in the physical world. You can at least experience the changes you need to do for somewhat in your astral nature for your next life, which is probably what's going to screw you up if you're going to get screwed up, is the astral nature. There is a tremendous amount of benefits for humans who live a truly meaningful life in the astral world by doing the things that I discussed. Spiritual discipline is certainly part of the process. So certainly consider trying some of that here, because you get a leg up on it, you could say decades, if not more, of suffering in the astral world that's meaningless. Now, I'm going to leave the astral world because we've got a very short time left. And I want to talk about the monastic or mental life, and why that is probably even more important, because it's during the mental life that people start taking greater responsibility for them becoming their soul again. Now, what does it mean, become their soul? Their consciousness is separated from their soul. They're individually separate until they finish their life in the mental world. But during the time of the finishing, they have protracted periods of time, like it could be days or even weeks, where they are functioning as a soul and therefore have share the consciousness of their soul if they're in co-service with others in the mental world, particularly once they've reached the higher realms of the mental world and they've dealt with almost all of their egotism and or arrogance, then they have a tremendous advantage to live part of that time as a soul. Now, why is that so important if you're going to go back to your soul anyway? Well, the reason it's so important is because souls are so isolated where they exist in the human terms. They exist in this very small sliver, the middle of the higher middle world. And they don't have much experience with anything. They have to get it from each incarnate, and only those experiences that are beneficial, that's all they really keep or even have. The rest of it just goes away. And so the real benefit is that you get to still experience some of the realities of the life that you've lived, literally, with others, and in replicating the physical and astral world that you've been in before, and go through scenarios of how to live even more and better in those worlds, and to work out the various nature of conflicts that may have been between you and others in those worlds with the same people that you're having conflict with. And this, so you could say, well, can't the souls do that in the mental world? Well, they can do it in concepts. They can't do it in thought forms because there aren't any. So they can't construct the forms that those that are in the mental world can to interact through and with. They can only do it conceptually once they're rejoined with their soul. So they can do something the soul can't do, and that's the reason you want to have soul consciousness, but have it while you're in the lower mental world. And it's such a big advantage and such a big experience that it's well worth everything just to get that done. And it adds a lot to the soul, although the soul cannot keep much of the thought form issue within its structure. It gains a whole new kind of experience from all of the other light that is produced from interaction about things that are quote-unquote form. And learning light in form, even if you can't experience the form itself, is a huge advantage for the soul in its own way. At the same time, all the benefits, all the light that is created by a person while they're in the mental world or below is never lost and becomes, at a minimum, converted into this conceptual understanding from the soul. So it is a wonderful thing. You never lose it. And if anything gives you a sense of immortality, it is that. Even though the soul itself knows it's immortal, it knows that in the conceptual sense. This reinforces it. Nothing puts a smile on a soul more than a human completing their life in the mental world with hundreds of other humans co-creating potential things that they're going to do together in their next lifetime. And it's so remarkable when they create this because they're creating it in actual images of models of thought or thought forms, not just a concept. And they may go through hundreds of scenarios of various interactions that they think they may have. They haven't fully agreed on this because they have to see what the outcome is going to be, and the final decider of that will be when they rejoin their consciousness with the soul. By the way, when they rejoin your consciousness, not one ounce of it is lost. All of their individuality remains, and they're part of this bigger being. No sweat, no death, no suffering, no dread of annihilation. And nothing prepares you best for that better than the experience in the higher mental world, I mean the lower mental world, while you're working through all of the egotism and things that you thought mentally wrong in your prior existence during the physical and astral life. All those wrong thoughts, all those devious thinking, all the devious mental communications, all the lies and truths, I have to be undone. So that the full meaning of existence and of being righteous in truth is brought into us. Talk about truly becoming transformative. The mental world doesn't. The astral is a slower process, still with great benefit in terms of love and bringing people closer together. But nothing is more profound, in my opinion, than what can be done by those who have reached that level and can proceed with it in the mental world, the lower world. Now, let's finish this tonight talking about that brief time when we become part with the soul in our mental world. All of the experiences are conceptualized that are enlightened. The soul goes, whoa! And it's like a gift you bring to the soul. A lot of people say, well, doesn't the soul know what you're doing when you're in it? A few concepts get through here and there, mostly through what is known as the bridge between you and the soul, but it depends how many lifetimes you've spent building that bridge and how much help you have from your soul or angel to get it there, but not very much in comparison to this flood. Flood, it's like an orgasm. You're having an orgasm, rejoining your soul. Of concepts, thousands and thousands of converted thought forms into concepts, thought forms converted into thousands of concepts that the soul absorbs, that only are the ones that are enlightened, that helps it to say, so that's what the lower worlds are really like. I got it. That's what the enlightened part of God is like. Remember, all the things that are wrong, that are done selfishly, does not enter into the soul. Those things literally dissolve away. They become part of what is known as the Akashic Record, and you deal with them in your next life or lifetimes, but they don't become part of the soul. The only benefit to the soul, the only thing the soul gets is its benefit, and no other consequences. It's an amazing experience for the soul itself, as well as for us rejoining with our soul. It's a concrescence, I learned it, Alfred North Whitehead invented that word, of experience in which both the soul and its incarnate are becoming one again. And in that process, this flooding of enlightened concept joins them together, inextricably together as one, without any sense of separation or fear of death. Just an amazing experience. I may be a little bit too... I don't want anybody to say, well, I'm going right now, I'm going to go kill myself, and then I'll kill myself from the afterworld so I can get to the middle one. No, you can't achieve anything by doing that. That would short-circuit that whole life in its sequences, and it would bring you into a meaningless existence. I mean, you're not going to hurt your soul, but it would certainly rob it of this glory that comes at the end of the mental life for the incarnate. It's such a wonderful, wonderful time and experience for both. And if it happens when the incarnate is fully conscious, I call it awake, it's really, truly like an orgasm. Sometimes people don't remain fully conscious, they fall asleep. They awaken to the soul, but they miss the part of the soul experiencing all the concepts, which is a wonderful, beautiful time. It's a timeless time. But it's an experience that you don't want to miss. You gain it by doing enough spiritual service while in the higher realms of the mental world before your senses just get tired and devout. And you want to do that. That spiritual service leads you to this final, wonderful moment service. Whatever, it's endless, but of experience. Well, I'm running out of time, and I hope tonight's show has given you a better understanding of the physics in life and the changes in it after we die from this realm. Until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.